Hey, ladies and gentlemen, podcasting softly, your friendly neighborhood Kent Hill. Back in the chair, my guest today is one that I have secretly been thinking about trying to get a hold of and all that sort of thing, because it's based around a very interesting story. I read an article, and most people who will listen to this will probably know the story by now, and that is the story behind this really, what looked like a really massive picture called Empires of the Deep, a Chinese billionaire's folly. I know. So yeah, he got bored one day. He had too much money and decided to, hey, I want to make a movie. You know, it's almost like a childlike thing, isn't it, Jonathan? Where you wake up one day and you go, hey, I feel like drawing with crayons. You know, hey, I feel like wasting a crap ton of money on a movie and never really finish it, you know what I mean? Never really see it through to the end. But before we get into the fish movie, we'll save the fish movie for the grand finale. But Jonathan, I'm very excited to talk to you, because from all I've garnered in my readings of you, you are the apotheosis, or the embodiment of the journeyman filmmaker, or journeyman artist, if you will.
True, that's fair.
So, you know, so it's because you've kind of, there's never been, it seems like, I might be wrong, tell me if I'm wrong, for you, there's never been that kind of steady, like, oh, you direct a lot of TV, did a few movies, like what you would call the closest thing to calm waters for a workaday filmmaker, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
You've kind of been more on the roller coaster than the carousel, if you get my.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's a fair assessment.
Yeah. So where did it? Okay, let me put it like this: you love movies. What was the movie that really, you know, poured petrol on the fire for you, so to speak?
Well, you know, I mean, it's really hard to say. I grew up watching movies and loving movies, and yeah, as a kid, I mean, I picked up a camera when I was 8 years old and knew that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Right.
So at that age, I probably couldn't pinpoint any one film. You know, certainly, and this has been told a few times, later on in life, in the 80s, of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark was kind of the epitome for me. I became obsessed with that for years to come.
Right. And it's funny, it's funny you bring that one up, because there's a couple of people I've talked to recently that Raiders was the big kind of, like, that is such a good movie. You know what I mean? There's the difference. I always find that there's the difference between, there's movies that people love, there's movies that people hate. But then there's this sort of weird nether region I find in the middle, that there's movies that people just say, man, that was a good movie, right? They might never watch it again, right? Here's the thing. They might never watch it again. They might only see it once. But when you talk to them in conversation, they tell you about the movies they like, they tell you about the movies they hate, but every now and again they tell you, geez, I saw this flick, and man, that was a good movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, for me, for my money, that's where kind of Raiders, every time I've had conversations about Raiders, that's where it always kind of falls. It's like, man, that was just a good movie, right? Okay, because, I mean, yes, there are people who will say Raiders, you know, favorite film all time, you know. I don't think there's too many kids that came out of the 80s, or teenagers, or young people in general, where they don't have at least one or two Spielberg films on that list somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true, and I guess the modern kids would be with Jurassic Park is probably the earliest thing they can identify with, even though, you know, Spielberg hasn't done the later ones, but at least they understand the franchise. I tried to show my daughter Raiders of the Lost Ark, and she just wouldn't have anything to do with it. She thought it was boring, so I immediately had a DNA test and put her up on the market.
Right. Gee whiz. Yeah, I know. It is kind of sad, and I can safely say I've now experienced that too, you know. Like, what's weird is my son isn't into any of the movies that I'm passionate about that I tried to show to him and go, this is going to change your life. I think I've said that. You know, he goes, Dad, every film that you put on when I'm sitting with you, you say it's going to change your life. I'm still waiting. So I said, well, you know, the other day, I said, so, well, what is your favorite movie? Just curious. And he looked at me, and he looked at me like I was stupid, and said, well, you know, don't you? And I go, no, why would I be asking you if I knew, right? He's like, Dad, it's Spaceballs.
Okay, well.
And I go, really?
Interesting.
I said, that's, you know, because I was waiting for maybe a newer film, maybe a Marvel movie or I don't know, something new, something in the last 10 years, something like that, you know. And he goes, Spaceballs. Spaceballs rules, dude. And I'm just like, okay, cool. It's very, very retro choice. I mean, oh, no, hang on. 30 years. No, it's starting to become a vintage choice. But, you know, I mean, isn't that terrible, Lawrence? With these movies that I talk to people about, like, and they go, oh, they're old. I had a kid that would say, oh, they're old movies. I said, don't start. What? Old? Forget yourself.
Right.
Forget yourself. Who are you calling old? And then you look in the mirror and go, oh, shit, hang on. Whoops. When did that happen? Where have I been? Yeah, that's
absolutely true. I mean, I there's a theater near me a movie house near me that plays vintage films every Tuesday.
Right.
And sometimes they'll play something, I'll go check it out, and it's like, wow, that just didn't really hold up for me.
Yeah, you know? It's funny that, isn't it? It's funny, like, when you, like, some, I mean, the ones that you really like, you revisit, but and you always kind of get what you want out of them. But there's certainly a couple, like, since this, the whole K thing, the 4K, 8K, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of films that I really like but I don't like them in 4K. They're not the movie that I like, you know. Because it's just too sharp. Doesn't look good, right? It doesn't look right. You know?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm shooting a lot of 4K now, and I put usually physical filters on front of the lens, but if not, then I try to do digital filters to just soften some of that because it's too crisp for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like it's not even reality. Like, I remember, you know how you go through those like hi-fi stores and all the TVs are there? You know, against
usually
one wall, and you go in and there's the TVs, and you kind of like, you see some of those ones, like they usually have a 3D one when that was sort of popular, and then those really, really crisp, like 4K ones, and it really makes everything look like it was shot with a, you know, like the same camera, you know what I mean? It makes everything, it doesn't, like, all of that, I'm not saying all of the art is gone, but it, because it's so crisp an image, I mean, sometimes the photographer instinctually will, you know, the focus is slightly off, and, you know, there's a reason, because you want to catch either a flare, or, I don't know, there's 100 little tricks that the imperfections make it beautiful, you know what I mean?
Well, that was the beauty of film. Film was inconsistent. Film, every frame of film every roll of film had a different characteristic to it, because it would be processed differently, the chemicals would be mixed differently, everything was slightly different. You never quite knew what you were going to get, but with digital, it's just ones and zeros. It's always going to be the same, and it's always going to be pristine. You know, film had a bit more magic because it was unpredictable, and even though you're not sitting there going, wow, that's really inconsistent, you know, it is in your brain, so there's something magical about it, and that's part of that magic of film, which is pretty much gone for the most part.
Right. Totally. So you fall in love with movies like we all did pretty young, and you don't waste any time, how you get into making movies with your friends and all that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I grew up making movies with my friends. If you ever saw the movie Super 8, my friends and I related to that a lot, sure. Except for the monster.
Right, right.
But, a lot of the characters, a lot of the things they did were us. And I'm sure other people's stories as well, you know, for every film filmmakers today.
Yeah,
totally. You know, could identify with that.
Yeah, I mean, I did it too. I don't direct movies. I'm more of a writer, but I didn't have a film camera. My grandfather had one of those very early video cameras. You know, the big ones you actually used to put a videotape in them.
Oh, sure.
And it sort of sits over your shoulder. And
Didn't you have the kind where the videotape was actually in a pouch attached to your, hanging off of a bag? The camera was connected to that?
I had a friend's dad who had one of those, and we never personally had one, but I thought that was the coolest thing. But yeah, we made little cop movies and comedies and stuff in the backyard. I mean,
that's great.
It's not called the Field of Dreams for nothing, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. No, I grew up making Super 8 movies, of course, and then or regular 8mm, then Super 8, and 16, dabbled in 35, went to video, went back to film. So I've kind of run the gamut with it all.
Yeah. So I mean, you really that lion in that movie, really, if you build it, he will come. Is kind of
right.
Like,
right. Build it, will come.
This type of beginning often leads, or is often the prologue, if you will, to a lot of filmmakers' stories. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I hear filmmakers who have made it through, broken through the ice and gotten their careers going, and then you hear their backstory, and it's like, well, that's my backstory, and somebody else will tell something, well, that's my backstory too. So that, I think there's just a common thread with filmmakers growing up that we all kind of had the very similar experiences.
Yeah. So when you sort of leave the playground behind, tell us about your next steps. How did you go on from there and continue to make the dream come alive?
You mean growing up making movies and?
No. After you finished, you'd grown up and you'd made your backyard movies. You go through school. Like, what was your? Was chasing the dream? Was it a smooth? Well, there's never such thing as a smooth climb in this business. But was it a? How shall we say? Was it something like the next step, every next step that you have to make, was it easy, or did you have a lot of setbacks on your, as you climb up this ladder? Now you're going from a kid who wants to make movies in the backyard to being a film student to being a professional.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Sure. I grew up. Yeah, my friends and I grew up making movies, and only two of us really stuck with it. Myself and another friend, and he's gone on to be quite successful. And we went to university together to study film, and got an internship on a movie that you've already covered, Reanimator.
Right.
Yeah, so we got our internship on that, and we spent a lot of months cleaning up blood and things like that, and. I kind of grew up with the notion that, you work hard, you get good at what you do, and people will notice. And
right.
And I don't think that really I don't think that really plays out all the time,
I've found it doesn't work in the movie business. I might be wrong. It might have worked for other people, but certainly the majority I talked to, it was sort of never about how good you were. It was more about who you knew.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, you have to be good enough to
deliver
pull it off,
right? Yeah,
to pull it off when you get the opportunity.
Exactly.
But you got to get out there and get the opportunity. And if you're like me, the guy who, to this day, will sit in my darkened edit room for 48 hours straight with coffee,
yeah.
and not go out and be with people and things like that. I mean, it's just not going to happen. You got to get out there. You got to meet people. You got to schmooze, as they say.
Yes.
Because that's really, really what it's about, is meeting the people that are going to give you that break. No matter how good you are, if you don't meet the person who can help you, then all of your effort is wasted. unless you don't mind, you know, being alone in your room at, you know, for 2 days straight or a month straight without human contact.
Well, Lawrence, what people do in the privacy of their own home, we won't comment on this program. But hey, whatever gives you your kicks, I say. But hey, sitting in a dark room for 2 days, I can't see it working for me. But I have sat and been undisturbed for 2 days, like trying to make a script work to try and impress someone. So I know what the feeling is, but you're definitely right. I mean, you have to be knocking on doors, so to speak, most of the time. You spend more of your time knocking on doors than you actually do being productive or being creative. The creative always comes when they open the door and they say, "Who is it?" And you go, "Avon calling."
Right.
I'm a kid with a script. Will you listen to me? it is like that cold calling. It's almost like I imagine if I had to compare it to an actual profession, I probably did. Or not a profession, more of a job that someone can have is like ringing up trying to sell people stuff, you know, like a telephone salesman.
Well, that's true with any artist. I mean, if you're trying to make a profession out of it, you've got to sell your wares, and your wares are you. You are your wares, you know, and so you've got to sell you all the time. But again, you have to be out there meeting the people and doing the stuff and working on projects. You know, if you're kind of a jack of all trades, it's hard because people do want to pigeonhole you. People do want to say, "Oh, that's the person who does this," or "That's the person who does that." Not, you know, a lot of people don't want the person who does everything and does it well.
Right, totally. So talk about moving into directing your first feature after you obviously, you finished your schooling and you're ready now to make your first feature film. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, my first feature was a movie called Dream Parlor, made in the late 90s, and kind of a dystopian future. As a matter of fact, while we were working on it...
It's got a very Logan's Run-ish type feel to it.
Dream Parlor? It had Logan's Run elements.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, when I watched it, I certainly...
Oh, you watched it. Oh, sorry about that.
No, I didn't think it was bad.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. No, it had a lot to be desired. It was extraordinarily low budget. We were trying to raise money for it.
Yeah, I thought the plot was very intriguing.
Thanks.
No, I really, honestly, truthfully, I thought the plot was very intriguing. I thought it was a very clever plot, and I'm not saying. My first thought is after I watched it, this is more with hindsight now, I think given different circumstances and being given certainly the means to explore that, I think further than you could have physically at the time, I think that would be a very, like a marvelous, like huge movie, like a big proper Hollywood blockbuster movie, because it's a great premise, so it was, of course I said, like, when I watched it, I thought, it was an interesting story. That was my reaction the first time. With hindsight now, it's one of those films that I have seen in my life where I thought, geez, if he only had some serious, a serious budget here, or a budget serious enough to tackle it, hey.
Yeah, I think we were about $100,000 on that, and that money came later. We were working out of pocket change for about a year and a half before somebody said, "Hey, I like what you're doing. Let me help you finish this quickly." It was all mostly budget. We were building everything from the ground up. It's not like we just said, "Hey, let's do a sci-fi movie using existing locations." I mean, we built every single set from the ground up.
Yes. Mm.
You know, so it was a kind of a massive undertaking for not just for a first film, but also for any low budget sci-fi.
Sure, but you're swinging for the fences. You know, you're trying to make a you're like a bottle rocket at that point, aren't you? You're trying to fly real high, real fast, and explode brilliantly so someone sees it. You know, like a flare on the ocean.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it was a story I was passionate about. It's a worldview that I kind of hold, kind of how people are and how society works. So it wasn't just me going, hey, look what I can do. You know, it was actually me doing a story that I care about.
Sure, sure. No, I honestly, that was I remember it fondly. And that was my initial, like when the movie finished, I was like, yeah. I was like, that was a really good, I thought it was the premise is what stayed with me. You know, I would like to see that explored more. You know,
maybe not. Well, oddly enough, that's something that I'm going to be approaching in the next year or so, trying to raise money to do it properly it again.
Yeah, well, look, good on you. Take all my money. Just let me know when it's coming. Let me know when it's coming out, because that has honestly been on my mind, and it wasn't until I read that article and it sort of led me to this moment anyway, that was and I found out that, you know, because I don't, there's a lot of films I've watched that I honestly can't tell you. I remember the actors sometimes, but not always the director. It's only if like I make a point of finding out who the director was at the time. But I mean, this was at a friend's house, you know, back in the, you know, 20th century. you know, so, you know, with a couple more cups of black coffee, maybe I could scratch something out of the ether, but it's not going to happen right now.
Right.
But I remember the movie fondly, and that was honestly something I wanted to talk to you about, other than, you know, fish movies. Well done, and I really hope you catch a break and someone sees the wisdom in letting you do this again.
Yeah, thanks. I've been working for the past couple of years with a Chinese company, helping them in some animation stuff, and they're talking about giving me a feature as well that I would shoot here, but with Chinese money.
Right. So let's talk about the battlefield between you making your first feature and before Empires. So sort of in between the second act, if you will, of this little story. So tell us about the middle. So you make a feature film. How does it pan out, like, after it's finished?
Complete non-success, other than we made a feature, and we did it on our own, and we made a decent feature for what we had to work with, made a lot of friendships, lifelong friendships, and a heck of a lot of experience that you can never get in film school.
Exactly.
We had a distributor who kind of took it under his arm, but didn't really do much with it, and there were some concerns there. There were just some things that kind of happened under the table that weren't entirely good, and so we pulled out from that situation with that distributor, and it just really never saw the light of day. We've self-distributed, and I think we get a whopping $2.35 every couple months from sales on the on that film.
Yeah.
I went on after that movie to direct another, an actor hired me to direct his movie, which he never did anything with, so I don't even think it's available on the market.
Yeah.
It was an okay film. I've kind of cut my teeth and built my career on working a lot for other people. I've done a couple of my own features along the way.
Right.
But I've really, you know, people said, hey, I love the way your movie looked. Who was your cinematographer? And it's like, well, I did that. And it goes, well, you were the director. It's like, no, I shot it as well. And like, oh, can you shoot my movie? So I kind of became I would say a glorified cameraman. Even though I'm really good with lighting, I don't, I don't really call myself a cinematographer,
right,
even though that's on my IMDb.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, that's a very, very prestigious skills, set of skills. And you know, I haven't studied it like the greats have. But I know enough to be dangerous and get by as a cinematographer.
Right.
And then also, I become a ruthless editor, so people come to me to fix their projects if it's not working, because I'm not passionate about, you know, what they're passionate about. I'm just passionate about telling a story out of something that isn't telling a story. So I spend a lot of time fixing other people's projects in post.
Right.
You know, and it's fine. I mean, it is what it is. I love to be on set and I love to be out shooting. You know, we did a music video that got picked up by the online sci-fi channel called Dust. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No, not familiar, sorry.
Yeah, if you look up Dust on YouTube, actually if you type in Dust and
Dust.
Nice Shoes.
Dust and Nice Shoes.
Shoes, you'll see a very strange sci-fi homage video, music video that we created that they picked up, and it did quite well.
Awesome.
And I just finished a big obscure musical in the San Francisco Half Moon Bay area.
Right.
That'll be coming out to festivals next year, and that's called Carnival of Wonders.
Right.
And in the meantime, between all that, and that's all kind of a big broad stroke. But going back to the Fish movie, or just between Dream Parlor and the Fish movie, you know, we got our internship on Reanimator. My friends and I, my friend went on to be a big, very successful Hollywood producer, writer,
right,
and is still doing that. And I went on to be what my friends call Hollywood's best kept secret, because
right,
nobody knows about me, but I can pretty much do anything that's brought to me.
Right, right. Well, that's a nice lead in, if you will, to the way I'm going to approach the Fish movie here. Another guy I spoke to who worked on it, who's kind of in a similar position to you. He has affectionately been known by Jim Cameron as his hip pocket guy, and that's Randall Frakes. And when I talked to Randall was actually, not long after I read the article, I had an interview with Randall.
Oh, okay.
And of course, surprised I was to read the article and see that Randall worked on the script at one point.
Yep.
So I asked him the question, you know, tell us about the Empires of the Deep, and his response was this. The short version is I gambled and I lost. I could not convince the Chinese producer that he was wrong, and I was right. He used very little of what I wrote, and what he did use, he realized it poorly. And I believe it was not a translation or cultural clash problem. The guy was just a dolt. Randall Frakes, I quote directly.
All right.
From the interview. That was all Randall had to say about Empires of the Deep. I will put a link, listeners, to the article I'm referring to in question, because I'm not going to go into it in any depth. It is quite lengthy. It is a very, very in-depth look at the production of this movie, which I'm not going to pour 1,000 questions over your line. So I just have a few that I've sort of picked out of,
sure,
out of the bits and pieces. A couple of them are quotes that you were quoted as saying in the article. And it's not really a question. It's more about, you know, is that that what was the feeling? What was going on at the time? And that was exactly how you felt at that moment. Do you understand what I mean? Okay, it's like for instance, the first one I sort of wrote down was everything I'd done in my career had been leading me to this point.
Yeah.
Right. So, naturally, were you, when this was all coming together, forget what happened, when this was all coming together, was it literally like that feeling that I can only imagine myself, as like, shit, I am going to be the director of like a big movie, a seriously big movie. You know, it's sort of like, I've made it. It's like a vindication or a validation, if you will, that I am a serious director. Why do you see this? This is going to be crazy.
No, I never had that feeling, honestly. Okay. I never thought, oh, you know, I've made it. I'm going to be, yeah, I'm a serious director. I've always,
okay, maybe I said that wrong. I don't mean that you... You know what I mean? Like I get
where you're coming from. And yes, the feeling certainly was there when I got in, and I knew the script was bad when I went to do this. And, mm-hmm. and this is not a slam on Randall's work, because like Randall said, only a portion of what he wrote actually stayed in the script.
Right.
And there was a hodgepodge of writers who never were really connected, who would come in and kind of do how they saw it, and it became very different every time, and the script was very inconsistent.
Yes.
You know, and I knew that going into it, and I told them that going into it. I said, the script needs work before we shoot. Mm-hmm. And they said, that's fine, just come on over and shoot.
Right.
And so, I mean, it did get down to the point at one point where I just had to tell them, you know, this script is awful. It's not even good. It's awful.
Right. So really, on this picture, you were kind of like, you know, Joseph L. Mankiewicz on Cleopatra.
Well, what had happened is you know, the Chinese producers and films like to have Hollywood names. Whether they're big names or small names, they want Hollywood names.
Yeah.
And that's very important to them.
Yes.
They ended up getting, originally before me, Pitoff, who directed Catwoman.
Yes.
And I had heard some really awful stories about the man.
Okay.
However, I got an opportunity.
What, personally?
Just from people saying, you know, he was, Well, I don't want to go to the details, but people were saying he was really hard to work with.
Okay, right. He was difficult.
You know, people were saying that he was difficult, right. and I had kind of pre-built in my imagination, you know, that he was kind of a Hollywood prima donna type.
Right.
And that's not how I kind of deal at all. But to round that story out, I did get the opportunity to meet Pitoff later and even work with him on some personal projects he was doing. And I got to tell you, he was just the nicest guy in the world.
Right.
So I don't know what they were doing to him to make him react like that. Not that he isn't responsible for his own actions, but if the stories I heard were true,
yes.
That's certainly not the man I met and spent time with.
Right. Okay. Right. So you were completely taken aback.
Yeah, I was ready to meet some jerk, you know, who was just completely into himself and nothing else, and not the case at all. Just,
right.
You know, the nicest guy.
Yeah.
And we worked well together on some stuff we did together. But that said, Pitoff left the production, and I had already met the producer a year before that.
Yeah.
And he basically wouldn't even give me the time of day. I just had a personal contact working on the movie that got me in to be interviewed as the director. And Jiang basically said through his interpreter, well, you've done nothing, you're nobody. If you go out and create a scene as big as something from Transformers and show me that you're worthy of this film, I might consider you.
Right.
You know, that's basically what he told me.
Okay.
So I was like, you know, okay, whatever, bye-bye.
Right.
And I did some notes on the script, and oddly enough, some of those notes were actually in the script by the time I got to China 2 years later.
Okay, so it was
Yes.
So it was a long lead into this. This didn't just like all bang bang bang.
Right, but what happened is Pitoff left. He
right.
just left. He just, as far as I understand, he just up and left, and they needed a director right away.
Right.
And they said to my friend, hey, does your friend want to come direct this movie?
Right.
And they called me, and we worked out the offerings and worked out my rate would be and worked out how long I'd have to be there, what the contract is, and I ended up in China a month later.
Right.
And to your point, to your question, yes,
yeah.
I got there, and I looked around, and I met the effects department, and I met though, I saw the wardrobe, I saw the stuff they'd been working on for the previous year, and I thought, man, I got this. I know exactly what to do with this, and I know how to make this work.
Yes.
You know, because this is like a low-budget movie with a budget.
Yes. It's funny in this industry when people come to that realization. Me personally, I just finished writing a script for a director. And I personally had not written this way before, because he said, I make B movies, right? So when he told me the length of his scripts, because I was trying to pitch him a different idea, right? And
yeah.
He was like, how long is the script? And I said, well, I've only got about 55 pages so far. You know, I've got the beginning, I'm into the second act. And he said, oh, most of my scripts are like 30, 40 pages. And like, because you've been trying to impress directors and you're trying to get your scripts between 90 and 100. Like, it's funny how people say, oh, forget about the rules. But when you sit down and write, you're thinking about all the rules. Like, yeah, if it's between 90 and 120 pages or whatever the D regular is, then you're okay. So when someone throws you a wobbler and says, well, look, this is how we do business here in B-movie land, you know, it's got to be this. And so you go, oh, okay. And, you know, so he said, when you do a smaller film, and I believe that filmmakers employ the same technique, like you said, when you go to a big budget film, is like you just got to be clever with clever with the elements, if you will.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you get there, and it's different because, you know, on a passion project or a no budget movie, you're doing everything. I mean, you're up till 5 in the morning, and then you're on set by 6 or 7 in the morning. And
in some cases, you're cooking breakfast for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you're just nonstop. You know, and if something needs to get painted, you paint it. If something needs to get built, you build it. And on a bigger movie set, I mean, you don't do anything. They don't let you touch anything. They don't. You know, I'd go to move something. I said, let's just put this over here. And I'd go to grab a prop or a set piece. And 5 guys would run up and, no. And they wouldn't let me do anything. And, you know, it's a whole different. And everything takes so long.
Yeah.
When there's that many people involved. There's so many moving parts and the parts are so big.
Well, there are literally teams. Like, there's the camera crew
yeah.
and the team and the stunt team and this. You know, it's literally small units that you are the general of, so to speak.
Well, yeah, and I mean, when they were shooting a lot of the stunt stuff, you know, which I have a background in stunts, I've done stunt work.
Right.
You know, the producers wouldn't let me be there. They're like, no, this is the stunt director. He's taking care of this part. You just go sit in your hotel room and work on the script for a week.
Yeah.
You know, I said, what?
I know. It's spoiled. We're spoiled, aren't we?
I guess
yeah.
so.
Yeah. I mean, oh, well, certainly when you get to those heights, I can only imagine guys like, you know, Spielberg and all those fellas who have never, you know, it's been a while since, you know, they haven't been regarded or are probably used to a certain level of treatment by those that sign the checks for these movies. So to speak, but you know, it's got to be like, I don't know. Tell me if I'm wrong. The way I imagine it, like, yeah, okay, you've made movies. You're sort of climbing up the ladder. But was there any point where you sat alone by yourself and thought, you know, wow, this is cool. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I do that a lot. I mean, yeah. I just worked, like I said, I just finished that thing, the musical. It's kind of like, you know, what if Alice fell into the rabbit hole and ended up in the Moulin Rouge?
Right.
you know, and that's the piece I just finished. And it was a dream come true, working with Christopher Childers, the producer and choreographer.
Right.
Because he's just like, hey, we agree on the concept. Here's the money. Go do your thing and let me know when it's done.
Right.
And then he did his thing and pulled everything together and pulled the people together and the dances together and the costumes together. And he's like, okay, here's the stuff. Make it pretty.
Right.
You know, and it was just like a dream come true. I mean, it was a complete creative collaboration with no egos involved.
Yes.
And probably the best experience of my, you know, my last decade in cinema.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great. You know, I mean, it's, I suppose when you distill it down, it's really every, you feel that way in regards to what I said. You feel that way whenever something creative reaches a climax, whether it's a huge success or it's known by some people or any of that sort of thing, but it's still like a fulfillment that is different from any other kind of fulfillment when you creatively express yourself.
Yeah, and I think having other people like your work is just a plus. I mean, I'm so far beyond doing stuff to impress other people now.
Right.
You know, I just do it because it's what I want to do and because I like doing it. If I put something in a movie or I try something, it's because I want to sit there and watch and go, I did it. I like that. Okay, that's cool. You know, and because it serves the story, I'm not sitting there going, man, my peers are really going to love this. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, you're going to work a year or two on something big, and a majority of people are going to go, it's all right.
Yeah.
You know?
Wasn't bad.
Wasn't bad.
You know, it was a hot day outside, and there was air conditioning in the cinema.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. You know, it was a two-hour movie. I got a good hour and a half sleep, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But,
It's like, oh,
well,
I mean, the
world is just consumed with so much media, you know, it's just, you can't be out there to impress everybody because there's nothing left to impress anymore. You just have to, you know, if you're making a movie because you're an artist, you make it because you're an artist and you satisfy that part of your person.
Yeah.
You know, if you're into the business part of the movie business, then you better turn a profit or you're not going to get another movie.
Exactly. And you're only as good as your last picture, hey?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, I've seen the coming of the insanity. I was at the movies not that long ago. I think seeing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a great movie. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
No, it's definitely on my list.
Oh yeah, definitely get down and check it out. It's definitely worth your a hot ticket, as they used to say.
Excellent.
But point of the story is, at one point during the movie, I looked to my left because there was a faint glow, the glow of a bloody cell phone.
Yeah.
And to my, I don't know, I was kind of had a, I'll put it down as a bewildered feeling, I think. There was this bloke and his, I don't know if his girlfriend or his sister or whatever she was, but she was... She was dead set watching like a episode of some TV show on Netflix on her phone next to him.
Oh my gosh.
While he's watching the movie. And I thought, man, that paints a weird future, doesn't it, Lawrence, where we have the capacity in our hands, you know, right now or in the case next to the computer where I'm sitting right now to take our music, our movies, our photographs, anything that gives us that, you know, take me out of reality for a few minutes type of drug. Your little happy fix, entertainment fix, whatever it is. We really take it wherever we go, and so the world is slowly becoming like our living. Like, that reminded me, like, what someone would do in their living room, not sitting in a theater where they've paid money to watch this movie, and she can't be bothered anymore because it's far too long, and her attention span left like an hour ago, and she's gonna watch, I don't know, some shit like Game of Thrones or something, while you know, there's this really good movie playing, but it's, you know what I mean?
It's awful.
Yeah, we've kind of turned the world into our own little private space, because everyone's either walking around with their ears plugged into something or their eyes fixed on something or, you know, it's really turned, the media has, you know, what is it? They live.
Yep.
They live is happening. Yep. Obey, consume. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, we're actually in a perfect crosshair of They Live and The Matrix.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So, yeah, these dudes really have foretold our future. You know?
Yeah.
You know, oh, well, we've just got to find the sunglasses.
Yeah,
so
right,
we can,
right.
So we can see who's on our team and not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think the sunglasses are just common sense, but that seems not to be so common.
That's true. My last question relates to another, my second last question relates to another comment that you made in said article. Sunk. And it's not really a question again. It's kind of more like a musing, if you will. You said that we wanted to make a great movie. Now, I put it like this. People leave when the credits roll, usually at the end of a movie. I have always stayed, and I stay for this reason. Without all of those names that people scroll up the screen, it's a bit like a war memorial, right? Without the hard work of every name that you see roll up that screen at the end of the movie, that movie you just watched would not have been possible. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, whether it was good, or whether it was bad, or whether you think it was the worst movie ever made or the best, or whether it made $1 billion or made $2, the people that started out to make it wanted to make a great movie. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's, you know, when you said that in that article, I mean, is that, that's kind of always the mantra of the filmmaker, isn't it? We just want to make a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of people on movie sets that are there just to, you know, collect their check and feed their families, and that's okay. You know, it's just a job. There's a lot of people on movie sets who don't give a crap, you know, if the movie's good or bad, as long as they get onto the next movie. And they do their best. That doesn't say they don't do their best. They're good, ethical workers, and they just do the work. And then there's a few on there who really, really love movies and just want to make good movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the biggest thing for me, too, on this, is I came in gung-ho. I mean, I came in thinking, okay, the script sucks. We're going to figure out how to fix that and work at it with it and make it better because it had so much potential. And the assistant director kept telling me after about 2 months, he's just like, why do you keep caring? Why do you just call action and collect your check and finish?
Right.
You know, and that was really hard for me to even fathom that kind of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm there, I'm away from my daughter, I'm there to do what I love to do. How could I possibly just, you know, call action and say, okay, moving on? You know, unfortunately, in some respects, I've learned that he was probably right.
Right.
You know, that in that particular situation, I should have collected the pages on film.
Right, right.
And, you know, and just be done with it. But on the other hand, I really did care. I really did want it to be something special.
Yeah, totally. But, I mean, as of right now, what do you know of that film? What do you know of its status? Anything?
I heard that one of the actors, Max Mulyan, saw it and said it is finished and parts are okay, most of it's not great. And I heard it will probably never see the light of day because there's all sorts of, again, hearsay, there's all sorts of legal problems around it.
Right, okay. So probably regarding people who didn't get paid and deals that didn't get fulfilled and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of really curious stuff going on. I remember at some point investors came to visit one of the locations probably 4 months into it, and I was told not to let them know I was the director.
Yeah.
No, that, and they came to the set looking for Pitoff, the Hollywood director.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, yeah. So,
right,
and
okay.
I told them the truth. I told them the truth.
Wow.
I just said, no, here's what's happening. Here's what the deal is. And like, oh. And, you know, they thought there were, so I don't know. There was a lot going on that just that wasn't right.
It would be you know. I tell you what, this would be. This would be a great documentary.
Yeah. Somebody started to do a documentary on this. Yeah,
oh, really?
I was interviewed for about 8 hours straight.
Wow.
And they never. As that may still be in the works. I don't know.
I hope so. I hope so. I think.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible. And 8 hours. Wow. That's. In the finished feature, they'll have 1 hour of that, and the rest will be extra features. You know?
Oh, of course. Yeah. rightly so. They also went to China and tried to interview people who worked on the movie because the one thing that none of the interviews were getting was the Chinese perspective.
Well, right, yeah, which is important to have.
Huge, sure,
yeah,
it's huge,
yeah, very important to have. If anyone's listening to this out there that is involved with that, yeah, get your finger out because I really want to see that. Someone was going to make it or I was going to try and do it. Meager as my means are, but I think it's an incredible story. So I hope they follow through with that because this really captured my passion for these kinds of filmmaking stories like Lost in La Mancha, Richard Stanley's doomed Island of Dr. Moreau, the death of Superman Lives, the Nicolas Cage Superman movie.
Right.
It really is like Jodorowsky's Dune. It really is the next sort of big, like, wow, there was this movie. Hey, you know, I've always had this theory. I'll run it by you. You can sort of say, you reckon, yeah, you might be onto something. You can say, nah, you were completely off track. What if this was a bloody big tax write-off?
Well, you know, we've heard that. we've heard that a long time. There were some strange dealings. You know, we got kind of a whiff of some of the provinces we shot in and things like that were actually paying the production to be there. And we were supposed to leave the set pieces up that they constructed as tourist attractions for this giant movie that was supposed to be China's Avatar.
Right.
You know, and the producer had done an unsuccessful television thing prior to this. And I think this may have been just some type of real estate deal,
right,
or money laundering deal or something. And for the record, well, I can't say for the record because this is still hearsay, but it's for hearsay from people in the producer echelons of the movie, that the budget that's been touted all these years is not accurate. It's probably closer to 30 or 40 million.
Right.
Not 150 million.
Right. Cool. Well, if you're out there, the people involved, the good people that interviewed Jonathan for 8 hours, I hope you get all that footage together because that is going to be a really fascinating release. Hopefully they got as many people as they could from all different facets of the production because that always gives you the best glimpse really behind the scenes.
Is everyone's
account from the caterers to the man in the director's chair who we've been talking to for an hour. I'm sadly not going to keep you for 8 hours, Jonathan. As much as I'd love to. One last thing I wanted to ask you about Sunk. Is it true that the article that they posted to get someone to write the script said screenwriter wanted Must Like Mermaids?
I've heard that. I've not seen the article.
Right.
Mitch Moxley, who wrote Sunk, did a heck of a lot of research.
Yes.
So other than a couple things that were slightly misquoted or not full information in the article Sunk, it was really close and really accurate. And I think that if Mitch said that was out there, then he found it.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Because I just think that's great. I would totally,
yeah.
I would totally have answered that ad if we could if I could jump in the DeLorean and go back, I would totally answer that ad. That's great.
You know what? Honestly, I would, if I had that opportunity, that exact same opportunity, I would take it again, but I would do it much differently.
Right. Would you be more cautious?
I would know what I was going into more.
Right.
I would understand it more.
Right. Would you still do it, even though knowing that the film may never see the light of day?
Boy, that's a great question. Yeah, I think I would have, and I would still do my best, just so, you know, I could learn from it.
Right.
But I think at that point, if I really knew nobody will ever see this movie, it's never going to go anywhere, and it's going to go down in history as one of the worst movies never made.
Right.
You know, I may change my name and go and do it for the paycheck.
Right. like you so eloquently said, I know how to be dangerous and get by, which I think should be a T-shirt. It's been a singular honor, Mr. Lawrence, to talk to you at last.
It's been mine, thanks.
I really wish all the best for all your endeavors and future filmmaking exploits, and I look forward to hopefully coming to a cinema or a DVD or streaming somewhere and catch me the next Jonathan Lawrence movie. Thank you for being on Podcasting Softly, sir.
Thanks, best to you. Thanks.
All right, all the best, mate. Thank you very much.